Right, let's get going. Good morning, everybody. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Peter. I'm a partner with NPM Legal. We're a specialist employment law and business immigration practice. We're based in the south of England. We work with businesses that are all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's where we help them. I'm glad I got that out today. 2 weeks ago, I completely stuttered over all of that when we had Sarah on the call. Delighted, as always, to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, everybody.
We're coming from a sunny, bright autumnal South Oxfordshire. As I look out of the window, it's a beautiful autumn day. And what are we talking about today? Well, it's got to be the inevitable employment rights bill, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else to talk about at the moment? It's going to be such a massive shake-up. But at least the good news is that a lot of this stuff isn't going to hit us for a couple of years. So we've got some prep time.
Got a little bit of breathing space, haven't we? But you know, we know time flies when we're having fun, so we need to get into it. Just a couple of housekeeping points before we get into the session proper. As always, welcome questions. You might have a load today. We've got quite a bit to get through in the half an hour, so we'll just take a view on what's coming in really and what we can do about time management, because we want to cover off some key points. But if you'd like to ask questions, use the Q&A function down at the bottom. We are recording this session. It'll go on our website, as always. It'll go into our podcast recording on Spotify. So if you want to dip back into it at a later date or share it with your lovely colleagues, then please do that. You will be able to. But otherwise, feel free to scribble away and take whatever notes you want to. I'm not going to show a slide deck for this, as usual. You're welcome to use the chat function as well. So, Employment Rights Bill. You know, any of you that are social media users and LinkedIn users will have seen, no doubt, lots of employment lawyers and HR professionals posting furiously about everything that was coming out when it was published on the 10th of October, myself included, myself in that bracket. We know now that the changes are going to be significant. They're as significant as we thought they were going to be, and more in some cases as well. We know the aim of this bill is to raise the floor, is to avoid the race to the bottom where companies compete on low pay, low standards and insecurity. That's what Angela Rayner says in the foreword. In terms of where we're up to, the bill's had its second reading in Parliament. It's going to a public bill committee. Don't ask me to explain what that means because I don't fully know. But it's going to a committee. They're going to report back in January. So we're probably going to get some more info through. Out of interest, the government's reported some, posted some, well, a few documents, actually. There are about 10 kind of background briefing documents. I think I put a link to them on LinkedIn on Monday, but I'll probably post on that later today. So I'll put the link up to those on LinkedIn. There's also an economic analysis report that's been done, which is really fascinating reading, because the cost of this is estimated to be £5 billion pounds a year to business, which is 0.4% of the overall wage bill. When you look at the businesses which are going to be most affected, so all these 0 hours changes, those businesses are estimated to take a hit of 1.4%, but the government are saying, hey, these changes are necessary, they're good for society, but there is a cost. SSP, £3 billion, really, in terms of those changes. We're going to talk just about we want to cut through the noise, really, and just talk about the ones that, you know, the businesses we deal with on a daily basis we think will be most impacted by. So we're not going to go through absolutely everything, because there's a lot there to unpack. We're kicking off with probationary periods and day one unfair dismissal rights. Obviously, that's not sector specific. That is going to affect absolutely everybody. And these are an ambitious set of reforms. So if you want to go and look at the bill, the bit to look at is Schedule 2 on probationary periods and day one unfair dismissal rights. And what Schedule 2 says it will do is remove the qualifying period for unfair dismissal. So Section 108, which deals with that in the Employment Rights Act, is going to be taken away. Why are they doing it that way? Because I know, like, Adrienne, you and I, we've had these sessions before and we've said, hey, the right not to be unfairly dismissed could be brought in super, super quickly via regulations or statutory instrument. You know, the government have got the power to change that.
Like they did before.
They've done it a couple of times, different governments. Why are they doing it in primary legislation? I know you've got the answer to that.
I know, I do have the answer, because if people bring in regulations, it means that other governments in the future can bring in other regulations to reverse what they're doing. If they change the primary legislation, it means that the qualifying period has gone entirely, and means that, you know, again, it would have to be quite a big consultation, full parliamentary process in order to reintroduce a qualifying period. So by removing it entirely, it's, you know, they're hoping that it's gone for good, I suppose.
Yeah, there's going to be a degree of permanence to this change. Whereas in the past, we've had a 6-month qualification period years ago before my time. I remember it being 1 year when I qualified, however many years ago. And then it went up to 2 years. They were all done without primary legislation, and it is different because it's primary. So what have we got at the moment? Well, you'll know we've got a 2-year qualifying period. So if employees want to bring what's called a Section 98 unfair dismissal claim under the Employment Rights Act, you need to be employed for that 2-year period with the same employer to be able to qualify to bring an ordinary unfair dismissal claim. Now, we know there are no qualifying periods for certain automatic unfair dismissal claims. We're not going to talk about those today, but that remains unchanged. There are actually going to be some additional automatic unfair dismissals, which we'll come on and talk to around fire and rehire, but that's not changing. There's no statutory probation period at the moment. I know some of you listening will have a 1-month probationary period, some will have 3, some will have 6, maybe some have more. I know some organisations that don't have a probationary period at all. You have lots of time to deal with employees that you hire and they're not quite the right fit and they're not, you know, doing what you need them to do because you've got the luxury of this 2-year period. So that's what it looks like at the moment. What is the future going to look like when these rules come in? There will be a statutory probationary period. The government is suggesting that should be 9 months. We talked previously about a 6-month one, but the government are saying we're going to consult on this, but we think it should be a 9-month statutory probationary period. That'll be the maximum. There'll be probably a different standard of reasonableness in terms of dismissals done during that probationary period. So slightly different legal test in terms of the unfairness. And there'll also be a 3-month period in which employers can dismiss with up to 3 months notice during that 9-month initial period under these current plans. So you can get towards the end of month 9, give 3 months notice, employee leaves at the end of the notice, so pretty much at a year's employment. They can still bring a claim, but you can still rely on these probation period dismissal rules in defence of that claim.
I think that was quite important because that's certainly a question that we were kicking around with some of our clients, whether or not you have to kind of look ahead and make sure that the termination happens after the 9 months or at the 9 months within the 9-month period. But no, that's not the case. Because it's the point at which you make the decision that the employee is not going to stick around with you. That's essentially, is that within the statutory probationary period will be the marker, won't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And when you're talking about the employee not sticking around and you deciding to dismiss during that probation period, these rules are going to apply where the employer can show the reason for dismissal was conduct, capability, a statutory ban on employing them. So some legal reason why you can't employ them. Perhaps you don't have
right to work. Yeah.
For your ears which twitching.
Yeah.
or some other substantial reason, but it's a narrower some other substantial reason, SOSR, than we're used to seeing. It's in relation to the employee. So it's not a kind of broad SOSR. It's still got to be related to the employee. Now, redundancy is notably excluded from that list. So what, you might think, what does that actually mean in practice? What it means is you get a new employee in 6 months down the line. Unfortunately, you need to restructure for whatever reason, and you need to make some people redundant. Right now, as we're talking, you wouldn't necessarily have to follow a process. To remember, the individual wouldn't be able to bring an ordinary unfair dismissal claim or a claim for unfair redundancy because they don't have that length of service. Under these new provisions, redundancy dismissals are excluded. You would have to follow a fair process with that person despite the 6-month service, and they have a right to bring an unfair dismissal claim for unfair redundancy. So it is going to change things significantly in that respect as well. The government are also saying they'll take a lighter touch and less onerous approach. That'll be the expectation for employers. So during this probationary period, during those dismissals in probationary periods, you can take a lighter touch and a less onerous process. What does that look like? We don't know yet. Regulations are going to be published in due course. There will be a consultation on it. What we absolutely don't want, because it brings us out in cold sweats thinking about it, is a return to the statutory dismissal and disciplinary processes that we had a few years ago, where there were all sorts of technical potential for technical failings and breaches and satellite litigation. So we want to avoid that. The stuff that I've seen talks about perhaps a a process where there's at least one formal meeting with the individual, that there's a right to be accompanied to that meeting, so trade union rep or colleague, and that you've got to provide written reasons for the dismissal. So getting those processes in place are going to be key. There's a bit of uncertainty still, though, Adrienne, right, about the practical elements of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be, I mean, there's all kinds of little practical considerations, you know, thinking about lengths of notice periods. So kind of right now in your probationary periods, you'll probably say, right, you've got a probationary period of 6 months. You might even have the right to extend it. And during that probationary period, you typically have a shorter notice period, for example, which might be, you know, if your standard notice period is 3 months, then your notice period during probation might be 1 month, or it might even be a week. So we'll have to look and see what the notice periods might be, whether there's going to be any legislation around that. Then there's things like, you know, what non-statutory benefits might be applied during the probationary period. There's all kinds of things to think about. We've had one of the questions I'm just going to answer at the same time is, you know, do you think you'll be able to pay in lieu of notice if you're dismissing at 9 months? And the answer is yes. I think in terms of notice provisions, those options that you have, which is either to make them work their notice, which we've talked about already, put them on garden leave or pay in lieu, that none of those are going to be impacted by that. But yeah, so it's there's the jury's out really. Until we see the detail of what this statutory probationary period is going to look like, we don't really know some of these uncertainties.
No, I mean, we know that 9 million people, 9 million more people are going to have the right to claim unfair dismissal as a result of these changes. So, you know, that's not an insignificant number, question mark, impact on tribunals. There are things you can think about now. I think revisit your probation periods, how they operate,
Yeah.
manager training, all good practice stuff. You can start to embed good behaviors now, get your processes straight, and then by the time these rules come in autumn 2026, you'll be up and running in terms of process. People will understand the guardrails. All you'll then probably have to tweak is the length of the probationary period, but all
Yeah.
the hard work you'll have done already. So there are definitely steps that you can take at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, can I just jump
Yeah,
in
go
there?
ahead.
Because I was thinking more in terms of the practice that we've got and what we see. And, you know, as I think we've said before on many, many webinars where we've banged on about manager training, et cetera, and dealing with people that are being dismissed with less than 2 years' service, is that the onus is going to be very much on the openness and transparency of managing that probationary period. So, you know, in the same way that actually it should, you know, performance and conduct issues should be managed properly throughout the life cycle of the employment, the focus is going to be on this. But what, you know, I think it's worth remembering that because of the increase on what we call short service dismissals coming up with discrimination claims, because people will go, right, okay, haven't got unfair dismissal rights at the moment, so, you know, I'm going to shout about discrimination, whether it's for sex, race, age, disability, you know, with the rise of mental health. What we've been doing with a lot of our clients is making sure that some kind of process is run anyway, so that the employer can put themselves in the best possible position to be able to say, this has got nothing to do with discrimination. So if that's the type of thing that you're doing already, so you are making sure that they're aware of performance issues, and you are making sure that you've got the evidence of those performance issues, it's probably not going to be the most enormous jump to make sure that you're in line with what you know probationary period dismissal process might look like. I mean, that was just my thinking from now, because of what we see. But then I appreciate we only ever see when it goes wrong and when these types of issues land on our desk. But that's
Yeah.
certainly what we've been recommending for quite a while.
Yeah, and it's best practice, isn't it? And I think,
Yeah.
you know, the issue is going to be you can't control whether someone sues you or not because it's up to them. And all
Yeah.
of a sudden, you have a degree of certainty you're not going to face an ordinary unfair dismissal claim, and that's going to change. And you're going to be at the mercy of an individual saying, well, you've told me it's for this reason, but I don't agree. So I'm going to
Yeah.
stick claiming anyway.
Yeah.
We're going to move on and talk about change management because there's a couple of points about that which we feel are really important. If you want a deeper dive into probation periods, we did a session on the 24th of July. So if you go onto our website or go onto Spotify, look for our 101 session from the 24th of July. It's called something like Why Probationary Periods Could Be Really Significant Soon. And, you know, lo and behold, they will be. I think a lot of what we discussed in that session, it's like a half-hour session, is really relevant still. So go and have a listen to that if you want a deeper dive on probationary periods. And of course, we're going to be coming back to this topic over the coming months, because it is the one we're getting the most questions about. Moving on then, the next issue we want to flag from the Employment Rights Bill is about change management. Two elements to this: one in terms of collective redundancy type exercises, so larger scale change management projects you might be involved in, and the other element we'll come to in a moment on dismissal and re-engagement or fire and rehire. So the relevant change is in part 23, and what the government are going to do is omit reference to the words at one establishment in terms of the rules under TULPRA. Now, those of you that are au fait with dealing with large change management processes will know Trade Union and Labour Relations Consolidation Act, Section 188 provisions. Basically, these are all the rules that deal with when you have to speak to employee representatives or trade union representatives because you're running a change process. And, you know, let's talk specifically about redundancy exercises. So at the moment, you've got to engage with employee reps that they've voted in, or trade union representatives, if you recognise a trade union, on ways to avoid, reduce, or mitigate the impact of redundancies. There's a ban on dismissals within 30 or 45 days. Whether it's 30 or 45 just depends on the numbers involved. So 20 or more affected in one exercise is the lower threshold, and you've got a ban on dismissals for 30 days after you start consultation. If you've got 100 or more affected by the proposals, then it's a 45-day waiting period. If you get the rules wrong, and they're quite prescriptive in terms of information that needs to be shared with the reps, if you get the rules wrong, you're exposed to a protective award. Now, that's aside from any other type of unfair dismissal compensation that the tribunal sees fit to award. The protective award is punitive in nature. It's designed to punish you for not following the rules. At the moment, there's a cap on it of 90 days gross pay per affected employee. So you can see in these exercises how that spins out into quite a large liability. As I said, the rules are triggered by a proposal to dismiss at one establishment, remember those words, one establishment, as redundant 20 or more people within a 90-day period. Now, what the government are doing is effectively closing what's been referred to as the Woolworths loophole. So cast your minds back to 2011, Woolworths, stalwart of the high street, sadly went into administration, I think, but had to close down, had to close all of the Woolworths branches, no more pick and mix for the children. They didn't follow the collective processes, and people brought claims, and they were successful in being awarded protective awards. Apart from those individuals who worked in Woolworths branches where there were fewer than 20 employees didn't get a protective award. Why not? Because the court said the branches were all, the shops were all separate establishments. They weren't classed as one establishment, even though they're all part of the same business. So you had some branch staff getting protective awards and some in the smaller branches not getting a protective award. The government are going to change this. How? They're going to take away this requirement for the changes to be at one establishment. Now, what that means is where you've got multi-site redundancies, so if you're operating a branch network, for example, I know some of you are set up in that way, you need to consolidate the numbers. So if you've got, you know, nine staff in London, nine in Reading, nine in Bristol, if you're dealing with three exercises, nine doesn't trigger the collective consultation rules. Add the other nine in, you're at 18, doesn't trigger the collective consultation rules. Add the other nine in, because you've got to look at all establishments. All of a sudden, you've tipped into collective consultation. So this is going to be quite a big change, right?
I think it's massive. And I think it might also just be worthwhile reminding people that we're not just talking about redundancy, we're talking about major sort of contractual changes. So if, for example, you know, a classic case would be you're closing your final salary pension scheme and introducing another one. So that's, you know, if your end game means that ultimately you might have to terminate the contracts of those people who don't agree to the contractual changes and then offer them new terms, you're caught up in this collective consultation process as well. So it's wider than just the redundancy as we understand it. But yeah, let's come back to that point about dealing with what I would call uncoordinated redundancies, because, you know, as a, if you're managing several sites, you might be going, right, we need to restructure this particular function on this particular site. Well, what it means is you're going to have to keep keep centralized numbers across all of your sites to see if you're going to hit that threshold. And remember, we've got, like, you have to look back 90 days. So if, say, on the 1st of January, you want to make some redundancies, you're going to have to look back 3 months before that to see where your numbers are, to see if the numbers you're proposing in this particular exercise are then going to mean that you bounce over the threshold. And the rules around that are an absolute shocking mess, because you could find yourself in a position where you go, right, well, that bunch we have to collectively consult with. But it also means that everybody who's been made redundant in the previous 3 months is also going to be, well, do we have to go back and collectively consult with them because they're now caught in the same group? So I'd have no idea what that's going to look like, but it is going to mean that you can't just look locally at your one establishment. You're going to have to look centrally within the same business.
Yeah, there's a lot to work through there, particularly around the consolidation of numbers. Because in your example, if you've got unrelated exercises, in as much as the reason in my hypothetical, the reason for making redundancies in Reading and the reason for making redundancies in Bristol and in Leeds are unconnected, but these rules say you still have to consolidate the numbers. So to what degree does there need to be coordination over that collective exercise? Do you deal with them as three mini collective consultation exercises?
Yeah.
And just throw this into the mix as well, in case you're thinking about what's our liability for getting the rules wrong. The government clearly don't like the fact that certain employers, perhaps, you know, a company like P&O, might have gone through a commercial calculation and figured out when it dismissed everybody or proposed to dismiss everybody, we'll be facing 600 protective awards of 90 days gross pay. We can do the calculation. We know what the financial liability is going to be. That means we can come up with a severance agreement package where we buy ourselves out of that liability, and it becomes a straightforward commercial decision. The government are going to be consulting in the future on removing that cap on the protective award. Again, what that quite looks like, we don't know. How would a tribunal, you know, go about assessing it if there's no cap on it, there's no guidance on what to do?
But it means the penalty still has teeth, doesn't it? Because it means that commercial decision to offer that money to the employees up front and go, well, this is what you would get anyway. It's not that straightforward. I mean, I guess there will still be those conversations, but the point being is you can't say, we know that the penalty will be X. It might be X times 100 if the cap comes off that protective award.
Absolutely. Let's move on and talk about the next element of change management, which is fire and rehire. So this is part 22.
Can we just answer this kind of important question that's come in? So the at one, the question is mainly is like, if when we're talking about one establishment coming out, it's a question of whether or not, you know, if you've got multiple legal entities, so you've got A Limited, B Limited, C Limited, all three are separate employers, but maybe within the same group of companies. In terms of my understanding, and Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, is that if you've got multi-sites and they're all employed under A Limited, that's what we're talking about here. It's not combining several different legal entities.
No, I think that's right. And in the past, the question of disestablishment is one the courts have grappled with, because it hasn't been as clear cut as that. When you're talking about just one legal entity, and the courts have looked at things like, well, you might have two sites with their own management structure, their own reporting lines, their own degree of autonomy, and their own financial kind of reporting
P&L.
Obligations.
Yeah.
You know. So that's where within the same legal entity there was leeway previously and currently to argue that actually different geographical sites, for example, can be treated as separate establishments even though they're part of the same legal entity. I think if they're separate legal entities and they're run autonomously at that level, then this isn't going to be, you know, you're not going to have to conflate numbers across those two.
No, and that's because the law refers to the employer. So if the employer is one legal entity, it can't be another legal entity. But, well, I guess we'll see when the detail comes out.
Yeah, quite.
Sorry.
Right, no, that's okay.
Sorry, bat on.
let's talk about change management part two, so fire and rehire. And, you know, I don't want to badmouth P&O, but they've kind of messed it up for everybody else in terms of these changes. So currently, anyone that's been involved in these exercises will know when you're trying to agree contractual changes with employees, they don't want to agree it. You can't vary the contract by consent. So you're into a situation where you may be saying, well, look, we need to dismiss you under this current contract and immediately re-engage you under new terms that have the change in that we're looking to make. You need sound business reasons to be able to make that change. So response to economic changes, harmonization, changing work practices. The issue with that is there is still a real inequality in the bargaining position, right? And I think there's dubious legitimacy of going to an employee and saying, well, you've got to consent, otherwise we're going to dismiss you, because now that's the alternative. There's a complete power imbalance in the relationship. And that's really what the government is zoning in on. So what are they proposing the future looks like in this? It will be a really
Grey.
cool shift. So,
It's a grey future. That's what it
yeah.
looks like.
Okay. It's not a bright autumnal future, it's a
No.
sleek midwinter future. It will be automatically unfair. Remember, I mentioned automatic unfair dismissals earlier, so this will be a new one. An automatic unfair dismissal to dismiss an employee if the principal reason is for refusing to agree a variation of contract, or if you're dismissing an employee to enable you to be able to hire another person on less favorable terms when they're doing the same duties. So you can't kind of get around it that way. That's going to apply to all contracts, you know, express, implied, written or oral. It isn't, in practical terms, it probably is a blanket ban, but technically it isn't a blanket ban. So there's a really narrow gateway that employers can get through to still be able to use dismiss and re-engage. And that narrow gateway is if the employer can show evidence of financial difficulties that were affecting the viability of the organization, and that the changes were there to prevent or eliminate or significantly mitigate the effects of those financial difficulties, and the need to make the change was unavoidable, then you can do it. But I think it's going to be quite a brave employment lawyer that's running through that list and going tick, tick, tick.
Yeah.
Yes, you satisfy all of that. You can make this change. But
But
it makes
also,
a huge
sorry,
implication difference.
I
Go on.
mean, at what point does the at what point is there a threshold? Because, you know, most it's not true that every restructure comes when somebody's under financial difficulties, but very often it's like foreseeing that there will be those financial difficulties means that you're taking steps in advance to do a restructure or a change management process, right? So, you know, I guess it's going to go through the courts as to where that threshold actually sits. That's what I foresee. And the other thing that I also foresee is that people will go, well, okay, if we can't change, we can't get an agreement and we can't change the contracts, then we're going to have to get creative, aren't we? So is that does that mean that we're going to see perhaps instead of just saying, right, we want to change your contracts, you would probably see a more more of a full scale restructure where we go, right, we are going to restructure, we're going to be creative, we're going to change the roles, we're going to reduce the roles, we're going to create other roles. So we go into redundancy, and then perhaps where employees are offered new roles as alternative employment, that's the way then that new contracts will be introduced, presumably.
And
I mean, I'm just looking at all the creative ways in which companies can still effect change because this is going to be difficult.
yeah, and did you mention about baking in the variation clauses to the contracts?
I didn't, but I
Yeah,
can,
so
yeah.
that's something that's possible, isn't it?
Yeah, so for example, you might see the typical wording of the company reserves the right to withdraw this at any time, or you might say that, you know, you might have a clause in which says we'll only apply this for the first year and then we'll review it. If you've got the first, you know, you've got the right contractually to vary it, withdraw something, then as a matter of contract, you can do it. But you've always got to be so super careful where if it's something major like a benefit, or something that the employee relies on, you know, say for instance, you're a very commission heavy organization, so you might have a base salary and a really decent commission. If you suddenly turn around and go, we're not paying commission anymore, you're very likely to be done for damaging the mutual trust and confidence between the parties, meaning that the employee can go for a constructive dismissal argument. But you know, that's also quite brave because the employee has to pick up and walk out.
Jump, yeah, and then take the risk of losing an ET. You might want to revisit your contractual terms and just see whether you want to put in a better variation clause. So you've got the ability to change contracts through variation. It doesn't then technically amount to a change to contract in the future because you're acting within the confines of what the employment contract says you can already do. And that's how you kind of could potentially get around this. However, I suspect that the regulations the government produce will account for that. Yeah. I think they will see that coming and head off trying to prevent employers from doing it. I'm mindful of the time. I've got a couple more to talk about. So by all means, stick with us. But if you need to jump off, then do. Adrienne, are you sticking around for a little while longer?
Yeah, I will do. I just wanted to add something onto that as well, because that was relevant to the Tesco's case that came up in the news a week ago or so, which is,
okay.
are we going to see an increase on things like injunction applications to prevent employers from making changes? Because as some of you will probably have read, Tesco's faced an injunction to prevent them from taking away a sort of like an enhanced pay for some of its legacy workers. So, you know, there's all kinds of this type of change has got tentacles, as far as I'm concerned, is that there's quite a few knock-on effects that could, that, you know, we could see an increase on. That was the only thing. Sorry, I just wanted
no,
to add
and
on
it's
that
a good
bit.
point. And it also reminds me that the government are also looking at extending the use of interim
Oh, interim relief.
orders. So these are
Yeah.
a really niche area, and they don't come up that often kind of in our daily practice, but in a whistleblowing claim, you can go to the tribunal and say, hey, I think I've been dismissed for blowing the whistle. I want you to order, and you do this within like a week or two of the dismissal. I want you to order that my employer, former employer, needs to keep paying me until we get to the final hearing. Which obviously
Horrible.
can be a super pressure point. So the government are going to be consulting on whether they want to bring in the same sort of power to apply in dismissal and re-engage cases. So that's quite an important one. Any of you that join our roundtable discussion on the Employment Rights Bill changes, we've got another session in early November. We'll be doing a deeper dive into those change management processes specifically. So you'll get the chance to network and discuss with peers about those changes. So just look out for that, those of you who are part of that group. Let's just round off by looking at two more things, flexible working requests and third-party harassment as well. In terms of flexible working requests, it looks like quite a tiny little change, but it is a material change. It's not groundbreaking in terms of what the government are doing, but it does open the door for quite a bit more litigation on flexible working requests. What they've introduced is basically a test of reasonableness. So right now with flexible working requests, employees can request from day one. We know that was the right that came in from April. You've got to deal with the request in a reasonable manner, got to reply within 2 months. You can only say no to the request if it's on the basis of one of eight statutory grounds, or you can rely on more than one, but there are eight specific reasons that it has to fall into as a reason for rejection. And the employee can complain to a tribunal if you don't rely on one of those grounds or the decision's based on incorrect facts. What's going to change? Well, when you respond to the request, you must identify the ground for refusal and also explain why you think it's reasonable to refuse the request on those grounds. And that's the change. So at the moment, there isn't actually an obligation to state why you think it's reasonable to refuse the request on those grounds. The more enlightened of you that are joining today will already be doing this, I think. You know, I like to see when we're looking at flexible working request outcome letters, a clear explanation about, you know, the justification for why the reason applies and sets it all in context. So it's not going to move the dial massively for those of you that are doing that already. Those of you that aren't going into much of a detailed explanation probably need to start doing that as a matter of good practice, and will definitely need to start doing it under these new provisions, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do see some where it's just like, no, sorry, your request is refused because it comes into inability to, you know, divide the work up amongst existing staff. That's it, love and kisses. So yeah, I think this reasonableness is going to be, this is why, this is the business reason, this is what we've looked at, and just putting a bit more meat on the bones of your answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Labour see it as a strengthening. The thing is, the bite, there's no more teeth in the bite in terms of the penalty. So at the moment, people can apply for it's 8 weeks pay, isn't it?
Eight weeks.
That's capped.
Yeah.
So £1,600, I think, max. That isn't changing. So the penalty isn't changing. So there's no more teeth going into that bite. But the gateway is broader for people to be able to actually challenge those flexible working decisions. And that's where the kind of inconvenience is going to be, I think. It's in the prospect of more litigation.
Yeah.
Should we round off quickly by just looking at harassment by third parties?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So
Big stuff.
you want me to talk about this,
If you like, I don't mind.
do
You just did a massive sigh,
you?
so.
Yeah, I know I did do a massive sigh because I think it's a really difficult area in terms of control. And we all know how much I like control. Anyway, from sort of 26th of October, the current position, shall we call it, is employers aren't liable for third-party harassment. Employers have to take reasonable steps to prevent it in the workplace. What the future might look like is employers will be replaced under an obligation to take all reasonable steps. So it's the addition of the word all, which is going to come in. Well, God knows what that actually means. And this includes harassment by third parties, meaning, it's anyone who's not the employer or an employee of the employer who is doing the harassment. So typically you might see, if you operate in the retail sector, it may be harassment by customers that come into store. If any of you have visited our hospitals, you'll see the signs up behind going, "Be nice to our staff, they're not being paid to be harassed." So, anybody that isn't an employee. So what the bill does is open the door for the government to publish regulations specifying what steps will be regarded as reasonable. And I hope they do, because very often, this is where case law comes in, because what's reasonable will depend massively depending on the size of the organisation and the resources available. So it becomes extremely difficult to work out whether or not you're going to hit that, hit the right threshold. But the additional bit is a disclosure about sexual harassment will become a protected disclosure. So anyone who raises it will be protected under the whistleblowing regime. So I just think that's extremely difficult in terms of what is, if an employer has somebody on reception, for example, and faces harassment by a member of the public who comes in, what are these reasonable steps going to be to prevent that harassment? So I think it's quite a tough area.
Yeah, it's going to be every reasonable step is expected,
Yeah.
and the
Don't let
regulation.
anyone in. Don't talk to
Regulation.
anybody. Don't let anyone in.
But it raises the question: if you're in hospitality and you run a bar and you've got people working behind the bar, and if they're taking abuse from a rowdy party, how do
Yeah.
you deal with that? The regulations will spell out more detail on that, so
Yeah.
we get to see what best practice looks like, and no doubt the Equalities and Human Rights Commission will update their guidance to take account of this. As well. So watch this space on that. Appreciate we've run over a little bit. So thanks everyone for sticking with us. If you want more information, you can go onto our website, look under our latest videos, and have a look back at some of the recordings of these sessions. As I say, do have a look at the probation period one. You can get that on Spotify and Apple Music as well. Just look for Employment Law 101. And I've been posting quite a lot on LinkedIn about these updates as they come up. And I'll put a link to some of the resources I've mentioned today. I'll post that on LinkedIn this afternoon. So do connect or follow me on LinkedIn if you don't already. I think in 2 weeks' time, we should have another half-hour session just on some of the other not so insignificant provisions.
Yeah.
Trade union reform in particular. Now, a lot of you today might think, well, we're not unionized, there's no prospect of that. But actually,
Oh,
yeah, I mean, the
terrifying.
changes really do shift the needle in terms of the scope for trade union recognition now within all businesses. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about SSP, bereavement leave, parental leave, some of the maternity protections as well. So there's loads more to come. So join us in 2 weeks' time for the same time. Other than that, I think that's it.
Round table, got a couple of people asking how they can get involved in the round table.
Yeah, just drop me an email. We've got a lot of people that participate in that, and we just try and manage the numbers because it's a forum. It's Chatham House Rules Forum where you can network with peers and have an off the record discussion. So they're not recorded sessions. We won't post about them. And if you're interested in joining that, just send me an email, peter@npmlegal.co.uk. I think my email address is on our website, NPM Legal. So just drop me a line if you're interested in joining the roundtable discussions. They're just a deeper dive on some of these changes, a lot of practical stuff. Otherwise, thanks everybody for your questions, and we look forward to welcoming you in a couple of weeks' time. But in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your week.
Thanks, everybody.